From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Capitol riot on January 6th has left lawmakers and many in the nation rattled. Progressive Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, among others, have said that she came close to imminent danger and even assassination. As more details of the attack come to light, it appears clear that the situation could have been far worse. Pipe bombs that inexplicably did not go off were found at the headquarters of both the Democratic and Republican National Committees on the same day. Armed men were readying a distribution of weapons and Molotov cocktails. More violence is being planned for the coming week. It is in this context that a bill aimed at curbing domestic terrorism by Congressman Bill Schneider that was passed by the House last fall is being revived. But critics worry that such an act, if passed into law, will only further erode civil liberties and curb legitimate protest. My guest is Branko Marchteach, staff writer at Jacobin Magazine and a 2019-2020 Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting Fellow. His book is Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. We had discussed that book with him on our program. He just published a new piece called We Don't Need New Terror Laws to Defeat the Far Right. Welcome back to the program, Branko.
Thanks for having me back.
So you start your piece citing Senator Tom Cotton, a Republican, who rightfully earned scorn last year when he called for federal troops to attack protesters involved with Black Lives Matter. Now, Tom Cotton has, unlike many of his Republican colleagues, actually been consistent and pointed out that he remains firm that insurrectionists should face the worst consequences or the strongest, harshest response possible. He published a statement that was then carried by the Wall Street Journal, where he said that those who attacked the Capitol should face the full extent of federal law. He referred to them as insurrectionists. So shouldn't we applaud the fact that a Republican is actually consistently applying the same standards to right-wing extremists as they have done to activists on the left?
Well, I think the question itself points out some of the problem here, which is that I think we have to be concerned when someone like Tom Cotton, someone who, as you say, in 2020 published this much derided op-ed, basically calling for the military to mow down anti-police brutality protesters under similar sort of reasoning, that there were protesters, a small minority of them, that did property damage, burnt down a police station, for instance, or attacked family-owned stores and the like. There were a small amount of protesters then who were engaged in violence against police, in one case, at least one case, even a lawmaker. And so at the time, Cotton's op-ed was really, if not laughed out of the room, was met with quite a lot of alarm.
The New York Times got into big trouble for publishing it.
That's right. There was an editor that had to resign. There was a revolt among the newsroom, and for good reason, because Cotton was lumping in peaceful protest and calling it insurrection and putting it under the same banner as that small minority of people that was doing violence. And for him, the point was he wanted to use overwhelming force to put down civil unrest in general. And while that was really criticized at the time, he has published essentially the exact same op-ed. Not in the words, of course, the words are a little bit different, but the point is the same and the target is very much the same. And he himself is very happy in the article because he says, well, I see now that people, liberals who criticized me the first time, and now that it's a different set of protesters, they have changed their minds and actually they now want force to be used once again on protesters. And it encompasses what I see as an emerging consensus, which is that not to take a narrow, limited approach here where you go after and prosecute and try and uncover the plot for organized violence that appears to have been at the heart of this, or you know, at least like a part of the protest, but to actually encompass the entire idea of protesting, occupying the capital, entering the capital, and even ensnare the people who simply were walking around, you know, may have committed property damage or may have done nothing but take selfies and sort of count them as terrorists. There are people like Matthew Iglesias who are saying, if we curb this stuff on the right, it'll be good because then we can later curb any sort of civil unrest on the left if there's another wave of massive anti-police brutality protests. So that
shouldn't
really
shouldn't the response to that be, no, there's a huge distinction between what the left is calling for and what the right is calling for. You know, the left is asking for police and authorities to respect lives and respect human rights, and the right is calling for something veering on ethnic cleansing.
Well, ethnic cleansing, perhaps. Certainly, that's how Cotton's op-ed kind of sounds like. Also, the protesters that he was talking about were not always people of color. They also happened to be white people as well. There were a lot of white protesters. So, I mean, I think for Cotton, it's more the traditional Republican law and order argument. The idea of, you know, insurrection was something that was used to describe, for instance, the Watts riots and some of the other riots and various actions that were happening during the 60s and the 70s. You know, the problem is that when we talk about terrorism, I mean, what are we really talking about? The right to say occupy capital, even though I disagree entirely with what these people are doing, they you know, were doing this for an anti-democratic reason to keep a far right president in power when he had lost an election. So the political reason behind the protest was bad. The right to occupy a building, to go into a Capitol building, that's one that has been used by progressive and left-wing protesters for years. It was,
but not to the point of breaking windows of the Capitol. Sure, there was, in Minneapolis, protesters burned down the police department, always ensuring that there weren't actual human beings involved. But I've never heard, and certainly we see like groups like Code Pink having gone in and disrupting Senate hearings and using their free speech rights and engaging in civil disobedience, paying the price for that, remaining peaceful, not breaking certainly hurting people. I mean, it seems to me that what we saw last week at the Capitol was of an entirely different nature, and equating what the right did with what the left might someday want to do is quite dangerous to the left.
Well, I mean, that equation is already made. Like I said, Tom Cotton is the one who says, you know, now people are on board with me. And I mean, there's not really a good distinction that you can make. The organized violence, the possible kidnappings, yes, that is something unique to this and obviously should be prosecuted with the full force of the law. But when you're talking about breaking windows and doing property damage, well, again, you know, that is exactly the kind of things that the right was saying to say that Black Lives Matter protesters in 2020 were insurrections. So I think we have to be careful about where we direct our outrage and what we're describing, because the really alarming stuff here was, one, those possible plots of organized violence to kidnap or possibly kill lawmakers, number one. Secondly, I think we also have to look at the fact that there were some very concrete security failures here that led to the storming of the Capitol. Thirdly, there's the possible complicity of the police. We know that police officers were involved in the riot. We know that Capitol police officers, in some cases, let people in, took selfies. Some have been fired or suspended because of their actions. And we know also that police sheriffs and other people in leadership positions around the country have expressed support for what happened.
Many of them traveled to Washington, D.C. to participate in the riot.
Yeah, exactly. And so there is a common thread, I think, between the police violence, the police brutality we saw through 2020 against Black Lives Matter protesters and the police's seeming complicity, which I hope will be investigated fully in this event. And to me, it is quite alarming that the idea that the way to deal with this is to give more power to the police, give more power for them to be able to prosecute people and spy on people and the like under a domestic terrorism statute, when they themselves are part of the reason why this event happened. So I think we have to really think about what is the most effective response here, instead of just going to repeating the mistake of September 11, and another a terrorist attack where thousands of people were killed. And what happened was, instead of taking a targeted approach against Al-Qaeda and other terrorists, there was a sweeping massive surveillance state that was set up in this anti-terrorism law, the Patriot Act, that empowered the FBI and law enforcement to spy on people. And that was ultimately not directed, for the most part, against those terrorists. It was directed at law-abiding Muslims, drug dealers, anti-war activists, and so on and so forth. So I think we have to think about outcomes here, and what the potential unwanted ramifications are going to be of taking this kind of line that Tom Cotton is so happy about.
The September 11th attacks and what came after, I think, are the closest analogy we can make to what happened last week and what is likely to come after those Capitol riots. People, not only has the country been traumatized, but now, of course, as you suggested, there is this legislative response that I think lawmakers feel they have to make in order to seem like they're doing something. So, of course, we have the impeachment of Donald Trump, but then do we? I mean, is there a clear case that can be made that we do not need any domestic terrorism laws because whatever we have on the books are sufficient to use to respond to last week and, in fact, ought to even be pulled back a little bit?
I mean, no one I've seen has really explained what exactly a domestic terrorism law, how it would have helped. I mean, this was planned out in the open. People knew about it. We know now that the FBI, first of all, warned some people not to go because they had seen some of the things they were saying online. And they were saying, you know, if you go and participate in this, it will not be worth your while. We know the FBI told the Capitol Police about this. We know that there were many, many warnings and that the Capitol Police ultimately did not prepare for it. Not only for the scale what it ended up being, but even for in the way that they would with any other protest. And, you know, as I said, that should be investigated. I mean, I think one of the things that we're not talking about is how can we have the right response to this if we don't even know yet what happened? Right. Why is it that the Capitol Police was so unprepared? Why is it that the Pentagon was so unwilling to send in its own troops? Why, for instance, was the National Guard blocked from coming? We have some public statements from people explaining these things, but we don't really have a good idea, and we don't really know to what extent, if there's any complicity. And I feel like we should probably know that before we start, moving to kind of just criminalize or put down dissent and protest. So I think that this is one of the things that we have to think about is doing a really full inquiry. Someone, for instance, has already talked about a 9/11 commission style inquiry into what happened, which I think makes sense. Have an independent body look at this, investigate this, and figure out what actually went wrong. Because it would be a tragedy if, like September 11, another product of a clear, avoidable security failure, what ends up happening is this heavy-handed response that is instead going to be used by law enforcement to, you know, crack down on climate change protesters, Black Lives Matter protesters, and so on and so forth.
Let's actually look at the content of the law, the act rather, that is being discussed. Last year, the House passed this bipartisan bill, the Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act. It was introduced by Representative Brad Schneider. And of course, because of Mitch McConnell controlling the Senate, it went nowhere. But this particular bill, in it, Representative Schneider first makes the case that white supremacist violence is the biggest internal threat facing the country, which of course has been confirmed by our own federal intelligence agencies, and then went on to explain that this bill would enable or authorize Homeland Security, the Justice Department, and the FBI to monitor, investigate, and prosecute cases of domestic terrorism, and then went on to talk about information sharing. And it just sort of surprises me. All of this sounds like what was already encompassed in the USA Patriot Act and in the Homeland Security Act. Of course, I'm not a legislative expert, but in broad strokes, what this bill is calling for appears to have already been on the books. It's just that it wasn't being applied in a consistent manner because, of course, white supremacists have been given a pass for so long compared with people of color who might be perpetrating crimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, trying to potentially take hostage and kill elected officials and police and others, that is already a crime. It is not as if there is nothing on the books that makes this illegal. And as you say, there's a lot of powers that law enforcement already has, you know, arguably too much to go after what was ostensibly meant to be terrorists, but of course, in reality, ended up being people who maybe expressed anti-war sentiments or happened to have other criticisms of the Bush administration, or just happened to belong to demographics that were considered suspect by law enforcement. So Muslim communities, Black communities, and so on and so forth. You know, there was a story this week about how there's an app for that Muslims use for prayer that basically was taking their location data and a whole host of other information, selling it among the clients being the US government. Do we really, given the fact that we just had Donald Trump as president, and you know, there's no guarantee that either Trump won't be president again, given that he plans to run, or someone with similar sympathies, given that the Republican Party is very much in line with Trump on a lot of things, particularly his hostility to Muslims and immigrants. And do we really trust the next Donald Trump or the next Tom Cotton or the next Ted Cruz, the people that currently are quite rightfully being pilloried in the media? Do we really trust them to enforce such a law responsibly, to designate only the organizations that we think are terrorist organizations as terrorist organizations? I, for one, don't. And after watching the events of last year, where there was such, first of all, alarm and then later relief that Trump's threat of declaring Antifa a terrorist organization could not be followed through because he did not have a domestic terror law with which to do it, it makes no sense to me now, given that, to start talking about giving the government the power to do that so that when the next Trump comes in, he can do that.
Interestingly, this domestic terrorism prevention act that was passed by the House last year was supported by Muslim Advocates, which is a civil rights organization, the NAACP, the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, the Southern Poverty Law Center Action Fund, Unidos Sikh Coalition, the Human Rights Campaign, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, Jewish Action, Bend the Arc, Arab American Institute, Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism. I mean, these are many, many progressive organizations or organizations that would consider themselves progressive. Why do you think they backed this law?
I mean, I think part of it is that there is an alarm over white supremacist violence, and which is completely understandable. Of course, white supremacist and far-right violence is the most prevalent type of political violence in the world, and certainly in the United States. It's not Muslims and other groups. So I think part of that is it's an understandable desire to protect oneself, in the same way that people saw a understandably a threat to their lives and safety from the September 11 attacks, and they thought, well, you know what, it's worth maybe pushing the boundaries here if it means that we're going to keep our families safe.
Not as much on the left, though. I mean, there were some liberal groups, absolutely, and Democrats who were, just as vehement as the Republicans at going after people who are perceived as terrorists. But a lot, the majority of the left, especially in the grassroots, were terrified about the backlash and the way in which the anti-terror laws would be implemented, and with good reason. We've seen in the years since how many Muslim Americans, immigrants, people of color in general became victims of these laws. But do you think, I'm wondering finally, Marco, if you think that, do you think what we really need is more of a cultural conversation? You can't legislate the end of white supremacy, but we can start through grassroots organizing, through education, through speaking out and organizing on the left, change our culture to give no quarter to white supremacy and far-right extremism. Isn't that the longer term, harder work that's needed now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, what's going to change this is a political solution. What has to happen? It would be great if we could just say, you know what, Republicans and the hard right, you just don't get to run elections or be lawmakers anymore. You could potentially pass a law like that. It would be very authoritarian, but it would be a very quick fix. The thing is, though, that's not going to solve the problem, which is why people with these kinds of ideas have power. And ultimately, yeah, they have to be politically defeated and replaced. And it has to be a political shift, which, as you say, is a much harder thing to do, because it means winning elections and organizing in the bottom up, at the local level, at the state level, and so on and so forth. That's painstaking work that takes a very long time. I think, though, it's not only a cultural conversation we have to have. I think there are specific things that we can look at here, including, again, if at no other time, this should be a wake-up call that the policing in the United States needs to have a broad-based inquiry, and those far-right, anti-democratic elements of the police need to be rooted out. People with those ideas should not be, I think it's uncontroversial to say, the ones policing and upholding the safety and law and order. I think we can look at what exactly happened with the security failures. Ayanna Pressley, she says that as she was being escorted out of her office, she went to press the panic button in her office, and the panic buttons have been ripped out. It's things like that. They're hints that maybe there's something bigger going on here that clearly needs to have to be independently investigated, not by necessarily the Capitol Police, who themselves are under question, but by someone independent. And I think we can look at things like, without resorting to censorship, I think you can change, for instance, algorithms and social media so that they don't lead people down a far right pipeline constantly. I think we can look at things like maybe using finally the anti-monopoly powers to basically dismantle these massive media conglomerates that have ended up in things like Fox News and other conservative outlets that dominate the airwaves.
Right, Facebook and is facing such an investigation and a probe. Yeah.
Exactly, and I think that there's no reason to stop at social media, because television as well is another part of this, and that's kind of been left out of the conversation entirely. So I think there's ways you can go about this and prevent something like this happening, or at least prevent more people from being frankly lied to and radicalized, not necessarily by censorship, but by basically just either affirmative measures like reinstating the fairness doctrine, or reducing the power of these massive media entities. I think we should have a conversation about all of that, instead of just taking this reflexive attitude of, well, political violence happens, so that what we have to do is we have to pass a domestic terrorism law and give more power to the police that we suspect were maybe involved. And the last thing I'll say is, even if this particular bill, the one that you mentioned, is not especially controversial, at the end of the day, this bill is going to go through several rounds of negotiation and rewriting, and there'll be things slipped into it. The devil is always in the details. And what we find at the very end, the product that comes out may have things that are far more objectionable in it by the time it's done than what was in it to begin with in its draft form.
Well, Branka, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your piece about this story from our website. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Branko Marchtich. He's a staff writer at Jacobin Magazine and a 2019-2020 Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting Fellow. His book is called Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. You can watch the interview we did with him about that book on our website. And we've just now been discussing the debate around new domestic terrorism laws in the wake of the Capitol riot. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.